Today on the Radio Cafe, we're going to hear a talk that was delivered last year at the Lenzic, part of the Lannan Foundation's ongoing series of conversations with thinkers, writers, and activists. Today we'll hear Sandra Steingraper. She's an ecologist, author, and cancer survivor, and internationally recognized authority on environmental links to cancer and human health. She spoke in May of 2014.
So I want to begin by giving you an image that I hope will serve as a kind of rubric for our conversation. And I could, you know, show you a PowerPoint slide of it, but actually I'm a writer and I'm going to use language all night tonight, no images. So the images are going to come from your own imagination, so you're going to conjure this up in your mind's eye. So I'm going to begin by asking you to imagine a tree with a double trunk and suggest that this is a symbol, an icon of the environmental crisis, which is in essence two crises in one, like a tree with two trunks that share a common root. And one trunk of this tree of crisis represents what's happening to our planet through the accumulation of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. And if you follow this trunk along, you encounter such endpoints as droughts, floods, dissolving coral reef, and this unfortunate fact now that one in every four mammal species is headed for extinction. I'm going to say that again. So right now, we are the adults in a generation of people at a moment in history when one in every four fellow mammal species are vanishing, are going to be gone, probably within our own children's lifetimes, not future generations. We're talking about the kids across the dinner table from us every night. So that's one trunk. The other trunk of the tree of crisis it represents what's happening to us through the chemical adulteration of our own bodies and of the environment that we inhabit through toxic chemical pollution. And if you follow this trunk of the tree along, you find things like disappearing pollinators, right, who are provide us one in every three bites of food that we eat are brought to us by pollination. You find things like asthma from ozone, created when different toxic chemicals mix together in our atmosphere. Ozone, a very powerful cellular poison. You find things like pediatric cancer, falling age of puberty in girls, learning disabilities, and so on. So we have chemical adulteration on one side of the trunk, and then the other trunk representing climate disruption. So I want to go back now and kind of describe the climate trunk in a little more detail, because this is all the headline news today. And in spite of the fact that we're now having a national conversation about climate change, there's a sort of a lack of understanding on the part of the public about what is actually the problem. And this came to light recently when a survey was done of 350 perfectly well-educated, intelligent people who were asked to explain what the mechanism of climate change is, and exactly nobody got the answer right. And I take that as a personal failure on the part of the community that I belong to, which is a community of science writers, and specifically environmental writers. So we have somehow failed to bring the message of what the most pressing moral issue of the day is before the public, to bring out of the soundproofed scientific literature and lay it before people in a way that they can, that makes sense to them. So because I see myself as an educator first and foremost, let me just begin with some basic science education by saying that climate change is brought about by a phenomenon that happens when the sun shines both visible light as well as thermal radiation, or what we call heat, onto the Earth. And in the absence of our atmosphere, every time the Earth turned and was no longer facing the sun, we would all freeze to death at night. The fact that that doesn't happen is because the atmosphere contains certain kinds of gases that have the ability to trap heat, and that's a good thing. And not all gases are capable of doing that. Oxygen can't do it. We need oxygen, but it can't trap heat for us. Nitrogen. Did I just lose my amplification? Okay. I'll keep projecting until there it comes. Okay, all right. So oxygen is not a heat-trapping gas. Nitrogen is not a heat-trapping gas. There's really only two gases that can do this for us. And one is carbon dioxide, and the other is methane. And they're able to do this because their molecules are arranged in such a way that they vibrate along a certain frequency that is able to actually absorb heat. So when the thermal radiation from the sun bounces back and heads out into outer space, it's trapped by molecules of carbon dioxide and methane. And we're lucky because we don't freeze to death every night precisely because of these vibrating molecules. However, starting in around the year 1750, which marks approximately the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we began to load up the atmosphere with more and more carbon dioxide because we began to shovel coal and then oil and then natural gas into giant ovens to keep the lights on. And the byproducts of burning these things, fossils, meaning things that used to be alive, was that now more and more carbon dioxide was going into the atmosphere. And at the same time, more and more methane has been going into the atmosphere because methane is the chemical name for natural gas. And so when we blast natural gas out of the ground or when we blast petroleum out of the ground, natural gas often comes with it. And a lot of it either deliberately or accidentally leaks, because these are vapors, into the atmosphere, and it too is trapped. Now, carbon dioxide is a much weaker heat-trapping gas than methane. But it lasts longer. Carbon dioxide is the Methuselah of heat-trapping gases. It will last for 100 years, whereas methane, only a fraction of that amount. But methane is the Samson of heat-trapping gases. It has the ability to trap 100 times more heat than an equivalent molecule of carbon dioxide over maybe a decade-long period of time. So the trick is to ask yourself what time period you're talking about. But either way, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by about a third, but we have actually tripled the amount of methane in the atmosphere. And so why does that matter? We've radically altered the chemistry of the air. And what does it matter? Well, it matters both because of what's happening out in the oceans and also what's happening here on land. And what's happening in the oceans is two things. The first is that all of the world's plankton stocks, by definition, drift around on the surface of the ocean. They have to because they're out there photosynthesizing. And remember from seventh grade biology that it's plants, photosynthesizing plants, that exhale oxygen. That's how we have oxygen on the planet. And all of us non-photosynthetic living things are now then inhaling that. And so the plankton are out there spinning oxygen, spinning carbon dioxide and water into sugars for themselves and then exhaling oxygen. And they do this in the presence of sunlight because of the miracle of chloroplasts. Next to these photosynthesizing plankton are the zooplankton. And the zooplankton are little tiny animals that mostly represent the larval forms of things with shells, things like barnacles and clams and on and so forth. And so they form the basis of the food chain, right? And so they're both floating around out there side by side. And as we load up the atmosphere with heat-trapping gases, two things happen. One is that some of that carbon dioxide is actually absorbed by the ocean water itself, and then it turns into carbonic acid. And so now the oceans are 30% more acid than they were prior to the year 1750. And that's a problem because the things with shells, which are the parents of the floating around zooplankton, have shells that are made of something called calcium carbonate. And calcium carbonate will dissolve and go into solution if you hit a certain pH. So the more acid you make it, the lower the pH goes. And at some point, which we are now on track for, calcium carbonate goes into solution. So what we're seeing then is things with shells in the ocean getting smaller and smaller, and their shells are getting thinner and thinner, and that makes it hard for them to reproduce. So the zooplankton are in trouble now because of the growing acidification of the ocean, because of the carbonic acid, because of the CO2, because we're shoveling coal and oil and gas into ovens and lighting them on fire. Now, the phytoplankton are in trouble too, but for a somewhat different reason. Because water is a really good absorber of heat. And so 93% of that excess heat that's trapped into the Earth's atmosphere by the methane and the carbon dioxide is actually absorbed by the ocean. And so we're heating up the surface of the ocean, and we're creating temperature differentials between the surface layer and the lower layers beneath. And that's a problem because plankton rely for their fertilizer on fish poop, essentially, which by gravity would simply go down to the bottom of the deep abyss of the ocean. Fish poop has a better name in the world of marine biology. It's called marine snow. it's nice. Cold upwellings bring the marine snow back to the surface to fertilize the phytoplankton. But when you have difference in temperatures, that system of upwellings doesn't work as well. And so the phytoplankton are deprived them of things that help them grow, and they're now in trouble as well. So we're seeing declining plankton stocks. All right, we said that the zooplankton form the basis of the food chain in the oceans, so all of the fish of the sea depend on zooplankton as their starting point. But we depend on those fish, and so do much of the world's population depend on fish for their protein. But all of us depend on oxygen with every breath we breathe, and half of the world's oxygen come from the ocean's plankton. The other half are brought to us by land plants. So in other words, one out of every two breaths you take is brought to you by plankton. So our lives are intertwined. So we do share a sort of common destiny. So that's what we biologists are worried about with climate change in the sea. Here on land, we worry about things like drought. And we worry about agriculture, because especially grain agriculture depends on a very certain predictable pattern of rainfall and humidity in order to set seed and so forth. And so what we're now seeing is falling commodities in terms of harvest of grain and unpredictability in grain agriculture and so on. And then we have problems, of course, with pollinators because their life cycle and the life cycle of the flowers that they pollinate are being decoupled from each other. And pollinators also provide us a lot of the fruits and the nuts that we eat. So agriculture is one of the things that we're paying close attention to here on land. And also just making water available to us as drinking water, which is one of the big issues, of course, here in New Mexico. All right, that's my story about climate change. I just wanted to get the kind of basic science out of the way so we can now go on to solve the problem. I want to submit that the root of this tree of crisis is dependency on fossil fuels. And I think it's easiest to see that when we talk about the climate change, because clearly when we light fossils on fire, their combustion byproducts, namely carbon dioxide, or their uncombusted fugitive emissions, namely methane, become greenhouse gases. But we also use fossil fuels as feedstocks for petrochemicals. And in so doing, we can create toxic substances that tinker with cell signaling pathways and alter gene expression in ways that place cells on the pathway to tumor formation or otherwise contribute to chronic illness or alter the course of development. And of course, then in burning fossil fuels, we also create not just carbon dioxide, but things like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and other byproducts that can combine together to form smog, which is ozone, three oxygens together. And ozone shortens lives, is linked to asthma, heart attack, stroke risk, and so forth. And so both by the synthetic chemicals that we make from fossil fuels and by their toxic combustion byproducts, our bodies become the repositories for inherently toxic chemicals. So I'm going to just put a finer point on this. We tend to think of natural gas solely as a greenhouse gas, but in fact it's also the starting point for plastics. So the credit card that you all have in your wallet is made of a certain kind of plastic, polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, and the starting point for that is natural gas. So your credit card began as bubbles of methane in deep geological strata. And I think that's the piece of it that is underappreciated, because in the unholy trinity of fossil fuels, the crunchy stuff, coal, the gooey stuff, petroleum, and then the vapor, the unholy spirit, natural gas. We can't really imagine that you can take natural gas and turn it into a shower curtain, right, or a credit card. But in fact, we do every day. So what I'm submitting here, I guess, is that in an age of extreme fossil fuel extraction, both crises are getting worse. With easy-to-get fossil fuels already gotten, the energy industry is pursuing a path of unconventional energy extraction, which is both more toxic for us and more carbon-intensive for the environment and for the atmosphere. And this extreme energy takes one of four forms: mountaintop removal for coal, and this is something that Laura has written about so beautifully, and I hope we'll hear more about that in the conversation to follow. And then, of course, tar sands, in which the soil itself of boreal forests in northern Canada contains tar. And to turn that tar into gasoline, we scrape the soil off. First, we have to cut down this incredible forest, scrape the soil off, cook it using natural gas actually as the fuel for cooking, and then send it in pipelines. One that's being proposed, of course, would run straight through the middle of our country down to Louisiana, where we would refine it into gasoline, where it would then be sold for export. The question before us is whether we're going to say yes or no to that pipeline. And then that's the second form. The third form would be deep sea drilling for oil. And then the last one is fracking, high volume, slick water, horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Fracking is the shorthand for that whole process by which we blow up shale bedrock to capture the bubbles of methane inside. So I'm submitting essentially then two arguments. One is that our materials economy is actually guided by our energy economy and is creating a public health crisis. And the road to toxic chemical reform then runs straight through our energy policy. So let me just give an example of that. In the part of the world where I now live, the northeastern part of the U.S., there's a proposal to build an ethylene cracker in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which is the birthplace, by the way, for Rachel Carson. Allegheny County, Pennsylvania is already in non-attainment for ozone, meaning the ozone levels, the smog levels there are above legal limits, and people are already having demonstrable health problems related to that. An ethylene cracker is notorious for generating the precursors for smog and will almost certainly make that problem worse. So why would we do that? What does an ethylene cracker do? Well, an ethylene cracker is used to change ethane into ethylene, and ethylene is used to make disposable plastics, like plastic bags and so forth. Do we have a human need for more plastic bags? Well, no. In fact, we're told that we should reduce, reuse, and recycle and carry cloth bags to the grocery store and so forth. So why would we at this moment in history, be ramping up production of plastic bags? Well, it's because we have a lot of ethane that's blasted out of the ground along with the methane when we frack. The methane is put into pipelines and sent to our homes so that when we turn on the gas stove or the whoosh of our furnace, we run our system on that. But ethane has to be separated out from the methane before it goes into the pipeline. It's also a gas. It's a waste product of the energy industry. We don't know what to do with it, so we're going to build an ethylene cracker in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, to turn the ethane into ethylene and then into plastic bags. So where will those plastic bags all end up? Well, we know the answer to that already. They end up out in the ocean, right, as tiny micro bits of plastic. They don't ever go away entirely. They just become smaller and smaller, as small as plankton. So that now there are places in the Pacific Ocean where if you take a column of water, the amount of biomass of plastic bits, microscopic plastic bits, exceed that of plankton by a factor of six. There's six times more plastic bits in the ocean, in some parts, in many parts of the ocean, than there are plankton. And then, of course, they're consumed by fish, and then we consume those and so forth. So the second thing that I want to submit is that The extraction, storage, and distribution and combustion of fossil fuels itself represents a public health menace. Whether it's pipelines exploding under Harlem neighborhoods and killing people. Just today, there's another evacuation caused by a fracking blowout in the eastern part of the U.S. An example I'm going to close with is happening in my own neighborhood. I live in upstate New York in an area of New York called the Finger Lakes region. And if you look at a map of New York, it's the part of the state that looks like a bear clawed it. There are 11 parallel scratch marks down the middle of the state of New York. And those are very deep lakes. That's our wine-growing area because these lakes contain so much water that it moderates the climate and makes it far more Mediterranean and allows us to grow wine there. There are also salt domes underneath those lakes, representing the ancient ocean floor that used to be there. So an energy company has bought up a lot of real estate along one of these lakes and is proposing to store the products of fracked gas in these old salt caverns, propane, butane, methane, and so on. This is a drinking water source for 100,000 of us. The kind of rail cars and the trucks that will bring these explosive gases to us represent a demonstrable threat to our health and safety, so many of us believe. So in other words, our dependency on fossil fuels is not only harmful to the atmosphere, but also harmful to our own health. All right. So I want to now talk about fracking, which is the issue for me that has been my work since about the year 2010-2011, so really for the last 3 years, this has been what I have focused my attention on as somebody who researches and writes about environmental health. And of course, it's also not just an issue for me because I live above the Marcellus Shale in upstate New York, and I'm in the crosshairs of the natural gas industry, but also here in New Mexico, where you also live atop bedrock in many places of the state in which the plan is to blow it apart, to fracture it, to extract this gas. So to begin this part of my talk, I want to tell the story of fracking. I want to do this geologically and go back in time and point out that 400 million years ago, there were ancient oceans that overlay many parts of what is now the United States. This place here was one, and the place where I live is also another. And the sea floor of these oceans, over time, has been pressed into shale. And the creatures that used to live in these oceans have been trapped inside the shale. Their vaporized corpses are trapped there. And so they're now bubbles of methane. So if you can imagine a kind of chalkboard under the ground, about a mile below our feet, and inside that chalkboard are tiny bubbles, like petrified champagne bubbles. Those bubbles represent the bodies of animals. So they're fossils, but they're not kind of hard, crunchy fossils like we think about. And so what are they? Well, they're things like sea lilies and squid. They're not fish, because there were nothing with backbones then. They're nothing with fins or scales, and certainly nothing with lungs or breasts or fur. None of those things had evolved yet. They're little tiny plankton, and they're sea lilies and squid. And so shale bedrock is an ancient graveyard of animals that lived a long time ago. So why are they methane? And why don't we all turn into bubbles of methane when we're buried? And the answer is that in 400 million years ago, there weren't a lot of land plants yet. And the Earth's atmosphere didn't contain as much oxygen as it does now. And therefore, the water of this ocean was also oxygen poor. And when there's not oxygen, you end up with methane. And so when these creatures sank to the bottom at the end of their lives, instead of decomposing the way they would now in a shallow ocean, they turned into methane. Silt covered them over. The silt over millions of years was pressed into shale. And voila, we have bedrock full of effervescent bubbles of methane. So what fracking does is take a drill and go all the way down a mile till it intersects this layer of shale. And then it turns sideways and burrows like a robotic mole a mile or more horizontally. Then explosives are sent down the hole to shatter the shale. And then following that is water, millions of gallons of water, which is really the agent of fracking. And then the water under very high pressure, sometimes up to 10 or 15,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, which is like swinging a bat against a chalkboard. The water then is the sledgehammer that breaks the rock apart further, allowing the bubbles of methane to after 400 million years of being trapped, to be liberated. Now, if fracking were only water, it wouldn't work, because as soon as the water comes back up the borehole and the pressure is released, the weight of the Earth, so-called lithostatic pressure, is going to press down on those shards of shale down there and close them all back up. So you have to somehow stick little doorstops in the cracks that you've created to prop open those cracks forevermore so that the bubbles can keep on flowing out. And the doorstops that you use are silica sand, because silica in a round grain is very strong. It can withstand lithostatic pressure. It won't be crushed and it won't crumble, even with a mile of earth pressing down on it. So you have to add the sand to the water and blast that into the cracks, and that works. Except it's not that easy. And if you only had sand and water, you couldn't frack. Because remember, you have to get the sand around that bend. And sand is heavy, and it likes to settle out. So you have to add chemicals to the fracking fluid. And one chemical that you add is a thickener to turn it all into jello so that the sand can not settle out and will be able to be shot horizontally into the cracks that you're creating with the water. Well, that sounds great, but then you've got this thick junk down there, and none of the bubbles of methane can then flow out of it. So then you have to add another chemical that breaks all that thick stuff up and slicken it out again and thin it out so that the bubbles of methane can flow out. All right, so then that sounds like it might work, except that it won't for long, because it turns out that the shale is not just a graveyard, a cemetery of ancient organisms that we're trying to get out. It's also a living ecosystem. And we didn't really appreciate that until about 30 years ago. But the shale is alive. And I don't mean this in a kind of metaphysical, you know, Gaia, Mother Earth alive. I'm talking about metabolically DNA, reproduction, and all that stuff alive. What lives down there is an ancient domain of life called archaea. And I know that probably sounds unfamiliar to you. It did to me as well, because when we learned about all the, you know, the kingdoms, remember that, kingdoms, phylums, families, all that stuff, they didn't have archaea. But my son, who's 12, they learn about archaea, because that's the new kind of kingdom up there that in the domain of life. And so what archaea are is kind of an ancient form of life, sort of similar to bacteria, but not, you know, quite different, actually, that have the ability to form complex colonies. And they live in deep geological strata, among other places. And they're able, actually, and I'll get into this a little bit because it gets me all excited. They actually, okay, I'm not just going to talk to you biologists out there, and the rest of you can just kind of hang on for a minute. They don't have electron transport systems, which is like this amazing thing, because every living thing does. If you don't have an electron transport system, you end up blowing up because of oxidative stress. So the way these archaea handle things is that they actually send nanowires out into the surrounding rock strata and send their electrons out into the rock and actually alter the rock and change the rock. In other words, these deep life organisms are altering their habitat to suit themselves, which all organisms here at the sunlit surface do, except that we don't think of the bedrock is alive. We don't think of it as a kind of subterranean coral reef. We think of it as the underworld, meaning it's dead, it's inert, it's fire, it's brimstone, everything that we came up through the, you know, Greek and Christian mythology about life below the surface. In other words, the biosphere extends much deeper into the dark heart of the planet than we previously appreciated. There are things down there that can send nanowires out into surrounding rock strata, and not just do that, but form complicated colonies and make whole grids of nanowires go across each other and send lots of electrons out there, such that the biologic is actually the creator of the abiologic, which not only troubles a notion in biology that everything depends on photosynthesis and all life is a surface phenomenon, but I would submit it alters our cultural idea about what the underworld is like. And given that this is a lecture about cultural freedom, I want to point out that our cultural idea about the underworld is wrong. that it's alive. All right, what does that have to do with fracking? Well, imagine if you send all those thickeners that you need to get the sand into the cracks. What we're talking about is guar, which is this great medium, like the stuff you make bacteria grow on in a petri dish. So you put all that down there, and you're really going to excite all these living organisms, and they're going to start proliferating, and they do. And pretty soon they're going to clog up the pipe. This is called biofouling by the industry. And then the flow of gas doesn't work. So you have to add powerful cellular poisons, biocides, things like glutaraldehyde that we use to disinfect things in the laboratory and in hospitals in order to kill everything off. So we're kind of conducting, if you will, an underworld pesticide eradication program in order to frack, which is one reason why fracking fluid is so toxic. That's the point I wanted to get to. So all of you who are non-biologists can now start listening again. I got through all the hard part. So fracking fluid is toxic for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is that we're deliberately trying to poison living organisms in order not to interfere with the flow of gas. The other thing about fracking is that it makes water disappear. And this is the only time in Earth's history that humans have done this in a large to a large scale. And in a place like New Mexico, I want to really put a fine point on this because there's a lot of kind of false equivalencies in the language around fracking where we're comparing the consumptive use of water in fracking with, for example, how much water is used to irrigate a golf course or how much water, you know, in here in New York State is wasted when we take water from the Catskill Mountains and send it down aqueducts into Manhattan. And water, it's a leaky, these are old fragile aqueducts and they leak. But that's different, right, because we're not actually exiting water from the water cycle. I mean, we may be transferring it from, in the case of New York, the Catskill Mountain streams, and now it's leaking and it's going to end up in the groundwater. But we're not actually making it disappear from the water cycle. But in fact, that's what fracking does, because you're injecting water, in some cases, a mile below the water table. It's never going to be, it's never coming back. So this is how I write about it in my most recent book, Raising Elijah. Fracking makes water disappear. This is worth thinking hard about. Usually when we say that water is being wasted, because, say, some misinformed soul opens a car wash in the middle of the desert or insists on watering the lawns during drought, we don't mean that the water itself exits the water cycle. But what happens to water during fracking is different to what happens to water when you leave the tap running while brushing your teeth. When a single well is fracked, several million gallons of fresh water are removed from lakes, streams, or groundwater aquifers and are entombed in deep geological strata up to a mile or more below the water table. Once there, this water is very likely removed from the water cycle permanently, as in forever. It will no longer swirl with tadpoles or ripple with fish. It will no longer ascend into clouds, freeze into snowflakes, melt into rivulets, cascade over rocks, turn with the tide, soak into soil, rise through roots, or flow from your tap. It will not become blood, tears, sweat, urine, milk, sap, nectar, yolk, honey, or the juice of a fruit. It will never again float a leaf boat, swell a bud, quench a thirst, fill a swamp, spill over an edge, slosh, dribble, spray, trickle, splash, drip, or glisten. Never again fog, mist, frost, ice, dew, or rain. It's gone. Once the investments are made to build out fracking and all the infrastructure is laid down, which is a lot more than just well pads, we're talking about compressor stations, condensers, flare stacks, pipelines, and so on. It becomes very difficult to dislodge all this. And because shale gas and oil extraction via fracking is a complex operation with many moving parts, the regulations are all also very complex. But are they sufficiently protective? Well, the data right now shows that fracking is not safe as currently practiced, and no evidence exists to say that it can be made safe through regulation. Indeed, some of the many risks of fracking appear now unmanageable, and some of the harms so created inherent to the system and unfixable. Thus, I argue, like lead paint, like asbestos, like DDT, or like smoking inside of airplanes, fracking needs to be banned rather than regulated. And we waste our time trying to create low-tar fracking or putting filters on the end of fracking cigarettes. It was a waste of time when we tried to stop the harm from tobacco, and it's a waste of time now. So I want to summarize a few things about the health effects, and maybe we can have a conversation more about them in the discussion to follow. But the first thing I think you need to know is that air pollution in the form of smog accompanies fracking wherever it goes. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has identified drilling and fracking operations as a leading source of smog in otherwise pristine areas. One of them is the Uinta Basin in the formerly pristine part of Utah, which has now, just this year, been vaulted to the number 10 spot of the most smog-contaminated counties in the United States. And the amount of drilling that goes on there is equivalent to 100 million cars in terms of the amount of air pollution that is there. And there are costly consequences for smog, including asthma, and emerging data are now showing elevated rates of childhood asthma in heavily fracked areas of Texas. We're also beginning to see elevated rates of birth defects in heavily fracked areas of Colorado, and increased risk for low birth weight among infants born to mothers residing near gas drills in heavily fracked areas of Pennsylvania. And besides being a human rights crisis, these are all terribly expensive problems whose monetized costs have not yet been projected. And we also know from industry's own data and from data collected from the state of Pennsylvania that 5% of wells are structurally compromised and fail immediately, and this proportion increases with age as cement casings crack, shrink, and crumble. This engineering problem sets the stage for drinking water contamination, and this is now exactly what the data show. We have good data confirmed now for drinking water contamination from drilling and fracking operations in four states, Texas, Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. And these findings are now corroborated by university studies as well, including a University of Missouri study that has identified endocrine-disrupting chemicals, namely chemicals that interfere with our hormones, in fracking chemicals and in water collected near drilling operations, including the Colorado River itself. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do now? Today's the day that we get to all read what our own government has to say about climate change. Earlier, a few months ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its own big report. And the message is pretty clear that we need to simply get off of fossil fuels. The fossils need to stay in the ground, and we need to build our materials economy and turn on the lights by doing something else. In fact, we have very good data to suggest that if we want to prevent really going off of the climate cliff and creating changes that are progressive and will keep going, that we will be runaway and we won't be able to stop, we actually need to draw down our use of fossil fuels by about 80% within the next few decades, meaning within our lifespans, depending on how old you are, or certainly within our children's lifespans. So again, I'm gonna put a finer point on this. It so happens that we're the adults alive now at this moment in history when, because carbon dioxide lasts for 100 years, we are facing the problem of not only the carbon dioxide and methane that we're adding to the atmosphere, but for the last 100 years or so, we've already got all that from generations before us in the atmosphere. And so we're at the last straw breaking the camel's back point in time. So because all the generations of adults before us felt too depressed about the problem and fell into paralyzing despair and couldn't really do anything, we're now the people that have to be heroes and actually do something before the window of opportunity slams entirely shut and nothing but complete misery lies ahead for the people we've left behind. So how can we do that? If we know that we have to leave the fossils in the ground, how do we do it? And I guess there's two ways to answer the question. One is the technological answer, by what do we replace the fossils with? And the other is the cultural answer. So I want you now actually to take your cell phones out and turn them on, or whatever iPad or electronic device that allows you to get online. We're going to do this together. I could, of course, show you a PowerPoint slide, but if you do this on your own cell phone, then you'll have it sort of bookmarked and you'll know how to find it again. So what I'd like you to do when you turn your cell phones on is go to a website called thesolutionsproject.org. Thesolutionsproject.org. And I'll do that too, so we'll do this in real time here. All right, so this is the solutionsproject.org. This is the popular version of a peer-reviewed study that was put together by Mark Jacobson at Stanford University and some of his colleagues at Cornell, who are the scientists, along with some really crack economists. And so what they projected here is a plan for all 50 states, which would allow us to get off of fossil fuels in time to prevent disaster. And it is a blueprint for what we're going to replace it with, and also how we're going to fund that, where the capital investment's going to come from, how many jobs will it create or destroy, and so on. And so what I want you to do here, now that you've got it, is go to, do you see how you can choose any state? Go to New Mexico and check out the plan, to click on that and go and check out the plan for New Mexico. Because obviously the plan to get Maine off of fossil fuels is going to be different than the plan to get New Mexico off of fossil fuels. So every state is going to run its economy on wind, water, or solar power, but the mix is going to be different. In New York, where actually the plan requires us to, 40% of our energy is going to come from offshore wind. That was a surprise to us. So that's all I want you to do. I just want you to see this. And then if you want to just, you know, keep reading and looking at it and studying it while I finish my remarks, that's fine. I'm good with that. But I want you to go back to it later tonight. And what I want you to think about as you read this over is it realistic? Is it realistic? And if it's not realistic in your mind, then I want you to ask the next question, which is, if we keep using fossil fuels, is it realistic to think we're not going to crash the climate system in a way that makes the plankton and the pollinators and our grain agriculture possible? Is it realistic to imagine we can keep on doing what we're doing and not have catastrophic consequences? So how can we create cultural change to alter the idea of what realistic means? And let me give you one example, which is tobacco. When I was 5 years old, it was 1964, which was the year that smoking reached its peak in the U.S. On my first day of kindergarten, we were welcomed to kindergarten and given a chance to do a wonderful art project, and we could take the results of our project home to our mom and dad, who we all missed a lot at that point. The art project that we were put to work making on the first day of kindergarten was an ashtray. Okay, so you think that's funny, but in 1964, that was just the rite of passage. You went to kindergarten, you made an ashtray, and then you handed it to your parents, and it was with the knowledge that everybody needed an ashtray. Whether your parents smoked or not, somebody would visit your house and smoke sooner or later, so make a clay ashtray, stick some little tiles in it, and take it home to mom and dad. Nobody thought that was odd or funny. When I ask my kids, when I tell them that story now, my 15-year-old daughter will say, "So what you're telling me is that 5-year-olds were put to work creating the infrastructure for a drug addiction that adults had. Is that what you're telling me?" She's right, right? And my son, it turned out, never saw anybody smoke until he was 4 years old, because it's banned in all public places and we don't allow advertising anymore on television or any place you would see. And the first time he looked out of a restaurant and saw someone smoking, he said, "Mama, there's a man out there in the snow trying to light his face on fire." And I had to explain to him, you know, what all this was all about. So To my kids, the point is that smoking is totally deglamorized, denormalized. They don't think anybody smokes except old fat losers. If you ask them who smokes, that's what they'll say. So we have managed to create a cultural change in which tobacco is no longer how we, it's just not the sort of normal default mode, right? So what if we did with fossil fuels what we've already done with tobacco, create that kind of cultural change? We know we have the technology, if you believe the Solutions Project is realistic. So the question then, and I leave it as an open question to you, is how we gain the cultural freedom, to use the language of this umbrella conversation we're having, how do we free ourselves from our ruinous dependency on fossil fuels by changing the culture in which we live. And so I'm going to close now by reading to you. But I want to point out that when you leave tonight, there are people in the audience who have come up with organizations and social change movements to help you get involved in making the changes that we need to make. And they'll be handing out a flyer to you for all the organizations in New Mexico that you might want to consider getting involved with to sort of realize this new abolition movement and be part of it. Because nobody's going to call you to conscript you. You have to go volunteer and find the army, the peaceful army that you want to join. And there's some amazing ones. This morning I had a 2-hour breakfast this morning with some really insightful people who are really making it happen here in New Mexico, including in Mora County. And I want you to know that Mora County is now known throughout the United States. We in New York are inspired by Mora County, with the first county in the United States to ban oil and gas development within their county, currently being sued in a federal district court. We also in New York are being sued by the oil and gas industry because we used our zoning laws to basically zone out fracking from our communities. So we're all kind of watching each other and seeing how this is all going to play out. The people of Mora have said our land has no value without clean water. And if that's an idea that you believe in, there are 1,000 ways to get involved in what the people of Mora County have already done to kind of shore that up. And so please pick up that flyer on your way out. All right. I want to read to you from an essay I wrote recently called Coffee in Jail. And I'm not going to spend time talking about my theory of civil disobedience, but rather I want to give you a picture of what jail is like, because it's the last place on earth, I think, that nobody live tweets from. We don't have an image of what it would be like in jail, and it's not as ghastly a place as you might think. And it turns out I have a great skill set. I'm a really good prisoner, and I have a good skill set for it, and it's a skill set I bring with me from being a cancer patient. Because you're in the hospital, the lights are on all night, the food is terrible, there's always a television blaring, and people can, you know, you're confined to a very small space, maybe to an IV drip, and strangers can touch you in your private places. Jail, the lights are on all night, there's a television blaring, you're wearing a uniform, and not a blue backless cotton gown, but an orange jumpsuit, and people can touch you in places, and you're confined to a small space. So everything I learned about how to make friends in a hospital applies to how to make friends with an inmate population. So I'm actually good at it. I think you should learn to be good at it too. It might be a good skill set to have.